Most Sunday mornings, you'll find us teaching through whole books of the Bible. And one of the reasons we do that is because we believe that in this book, we find the answers to questions that people have asked for centuries. Like questions like, why are we here? What's the purpose for my life? Why is the world the way it is? What's God doing to set things right? And, you know, the big questions, the life-shaping questions. And we believe that those questions are best answered in living in a personal relationship with Jesus and getting to know Him better through His Word. So every week we open this book and look at what it said to the people who first read it so we can apply it to the people who, to us, the people who read it today. And right now we are studying our way through the New Testament book called Acts, which stands for the Acts or the actions of the early followers of Jesus. What they did after Jesus died, was raised from the dead, and ascended back into heaven. And the book of Acts gives us pictures and snapshots of what life was like in the early church as they, in obedience to Jesus' command, spread the good news of God's forgiveness and life beyond the borders of Israel into all the world, meaning that Christianity, we see this happening in the book of Acts, Christianity moves from being a faith that is exclusive to the Jews to becoming a faith inclusive of every kind of person, Jew, Greek, Roman, men, women, rich, poor, slave, free. The gospel became available to everybody, everywhere, which is really good news, but not so much to the Jews who felt threatened by this whole thing. And that's where we are in the book of Acts right now. The great majority of the book of Acts is focused on this battle between the rule-keeping religion of the Jews and the resurrection power of these early Christians who literally are turning the world upside down. And the key man in this world-upsetting drama is a man called Paul of Tarsus. So take your Bible and turn to Acts chapter 25. We're going to look at chapters 25 and 26 this morning. Going to take a big chunk today. We'll get there in a minute. While you're turning there, let's talk. I've been thinking a lot lately about why questions, and I know that's kind of weird. You know, I'm weird, thinking about mind-altering meaning of the universe kinds of questions like why. But I was curious because I know that one of the favorite questions that, like, toddlers and little kids ask is the why question. Anybody know what I'm talking about? So to get help with this sermon intro, the first thing I did was call my daughter Christy, who posts all kinds of things that my granddaughter Addie says on Facebook. Some of you follow Christy Sober and you know about the Addie-isms there. But by the way, last weekend, all our kids and grandkids, we met down in Atlanta and we went to the Georgia Aquarium, and here's a picture of Addie at the aquarium. I think that's kind of the Mona Lisa of attitude right there. I think we're all in deep trouble. But anyway, so I asked Christy if she had any examples of Addie or her sister Nora. I got to get Nora in there. But did she have any illustrations or stories about Addie or Nora getting hung in the why question loop? And she couldn't think of anything, but she told me that our good friend Ruthie Zylstra, who works here as the director of small groups in Merge, she said Ruthie has been going through the why question insanity with her son Fisher. And so here's Fisher, and here are some examples of what I'm talking about. Ruthie said when she took Fisher's pacifier away, the conversation went like this. Ruthie, since you're a big boy now, you aren't going to have your passy anymore. Fisher, but why can't I have my passy anymore? Ruthie, because you're growing up, and that's part of becoming a big boy. Fisher, why do I have to grow up? I want to grow little so I can have my passies back. Ruthie, only babies need passies, and you aren't a baby anymore. Why am I not a baby anymore? And another one, they were walking down the road together, and Ruthie said, Fisher, get on this side of the road by Mom. Fisher, why? Ruthie, because a car can come and hurt you if you don't walk on this side by me. Fisher, why would a car hurt me? Ruthie, because they might not see you over there and accidentally hit you. Fisher, why would they not see me? Ruthie, please just say yes, ma'am, and come over by me. Fisher, why do I have to say yes, ma'am? So why? Why is a question of curiosity? We want to understand the reason for things, the purpose of things. So why is really a question of purpose? Why is a question of purpose? Why am I here? What's the purpose of my life? Why do I get up in the morning? Why does anyone care? These are the questions that define us, and it's having answers to the why question that keep us going when things get hard. In fact, I would say if you don't have good, solid, grounded answer to the why questions, then when difficulties come, you're tempted to give in or to give up, and the chance that you might give in or give up increases dramatically. So what I want to ask you this morning, I want you to think about the question, what is your why? What is your why? And this is a big deal. It's a really big deal. Interestingly enough, why is a big deal in the business world in our world today. Everybody's talking about finding your why, and I think it all started with a business book that was written by a man named Simon Sinek, who teaches graduate level courses in strategic communication at Columbia University, and now he's speaking all over the country about why. But he wrote a book entitled Start With Why. And by the way, there's a great TED talk on all of this if you want a quick overview of the book. But basically, Sinek's big idea is something like, why what you do is not as important as why you do it. What you do is not nearly as important as why you do it. Really, it's not what you do that defines you on the deepest level, that keeps you going when the odds are stacked against you. It's why you do what you do that matters most. Now, in an extremely broad description, Start With Why is a book that talks about three aspects of a leader or an organization, the why and the how and the what, and it's what Sinek calls the golden circle. Now, the what is easy to explain. It's simply what an organization or a leader or what anybody, for that matter, does. Like, I'm a doctor, I'm a pastor, I'm a lawyer, I'm a stay-at-home mom, I'm a counselor, I'm an entrepreneur, construction worker, business owner, corporate exec, or applied to an organization, our company designs packaging, makes tires, helps people find jobs, builds homes, offers some kind of goods and services, whatever. But what is easy? 100% of people and organizations know what they do. And how is, of course, the approach, the way that you approach doing what you do. And that's not really that hard to explain either. It's the way that you take care of your children, the office hours you keep, the customer service that you offer, your particular approach to counseling, your particular approach to remodeling homes. Your particular how involves your values, involves your DNA. Now, like here at Fellowship Greenville, what we do is that we create environments for worship and community and service or mission, and we invite and challenge people to passionately pursue life and mission with Jesus. That's our what. How we do it is we do more expositional teaching than topical preaching. We do more participatory worship rather than performance-based music. We do more team leadership than hierarchical leadership. We focus more on equipping than events, and we make decisions pneumatically, looking for the Spirit to lead and guide more than pragmatically. That's how we do what we do. And then there's the why. Why do we do what we do, how we do it? Why is your purpose? Why is your reason for being? It's why you get up in the morning that keeps you going. Our why is to reintroduce people to Jesus and the life that he offers, because most people really don't know who Jesus is today. Our culture is confused, have wrong-headed ideas about who Jesus is, so we want to reintroduce them. That's our why. Now, Sinek says our biggest problem is that we tend to live in this circle from the outside in, outside in. We know our what and how, but for most of us, our why is fuzzy. Or if we do get clear on our why, the problem is when circumstances change or when life or business gets difficult, in other words, when our what and our how get hammered, we tend to lose sight of our why, and if it happens in business, then your bottom line suffers, And if it happens in your life, you tend to get discouraged or derailed. And the key, though, he says, is learning to live from the inside out, to start with why. And Sinek says that that's how most successful organizations keep knocking it out of the park year after year, and it's how the most successful, satisfied, resilient people live as well. He uses Martin Luther King as an example. In his TED Talk, he says, in the summer of 1963, 250,000 people showed up on the mall in Washington, D.C. to hear Dr. King speak. Nobody sent out invitations. There was no web or website to check the date. So how do you do that? He says, well, Dr. King wasn't the only man in America who was a great orator. He wasn't the only man in America who suffered in a pre-civil rights America. In fact, some of his ideas weren't all that good, but he had a gift. He didn't go around telling people what needed to change in America. He went around and told people what he believed. I believe, I believe, I believe, he told people. And people who believed what he believed took up his cause, and they made it their own, and they told other people. And some of those people created structures to get the word out to even more people, and lo and behold, 250,000 people showed up on the right day at the right time to hear him speak. Now, Sinek asked, how many of those people showed up for him? He says, not a single one. They showed up for themselves because it's what they believed about America. They got him to travel in buses for 8 hours and to stand in the sun in Washington in the middle of August. It's what they believed, and it wasn't about black versus white. 25% of the audience was white, he says. Dr. King believed that there are two types of laws in this world, those that are made by God and those that are made by men. And not until the laws that are made by men are consistent with the laws made by God will we live in a just world. And the civil rights movement brought his cause to life. And he says, we followed not for him, but for ourselves. And he says, by the way, he gave the I have a dream speech, not I have a plan speech. He lived out his why, his dream, his core belief, and people believed what he believed, took up his cause, and they made it their own, and they told other people about it. Now, I think that's pretty interesting. Now, for a follower of Jesus, there aren't many things that matter more than finding and living out of your why, than finding your why and grounding your life in your why. So I ask you again, what is your why? This is a big deal. And the passage we're about to look at, the Apostle Paul tells us his why in no uncertain terms. Okay, so as I said, we're continuing in our series of messages from the book of Acts, and we've come to the chapters in Acts that tell us about Paul and being in prison under arrest. And so you may remember that things haven't gone well for Paul. His ministry has been plagued by what we would see as setbacks, but there's no more devoted man than Paul. Even though he's been falsely accused and arrested and jailed and stripped and beaten and stoned, he keeps going. And he's in jail again. As we pick up the story this morning, we find that Felix, the governor of Judea, has left Paul sitting in jail for 2 years. Falsely accused, sitting in a Roman prison for 2 years. And we saw that in chapter 24, verse 27, where Jim Thompson left off last week. The interesting thing to me is that from time to time during that two-year period, the Roman governor Felix sent for Paul because he wanted to talk to him. Now, Luke tells us that Felix did this hoping that Paul would bribe him to set him free. But regardless of the reason, when Paul stood before Felix, Paul went for the jugular. He didn't stand in front of Felix and complain about unfair treatment. He didn't grumble and complain about how it wasn't right to keep him in custody without filing formal charges. He does appeal to Caesar in chapter 25, verse 11, when it looks like that he won't get a fair trial before the Jews. But when Paul comes out of the darkness of prison and stands before the governor, he talks to Felix about Jesus, about faith in Jesus, and how faith in Jesus shows itself in living a right relationship with God and other people, in a life of self-control, in a life that bears in mind that God's judgment is coming, which scared the bejeebers out of Felix. And now, Paul standing before Felix, and as we'll see today, Paul standing before Felix successor, Festus, and King Agrippa, all this is something that Jesus told Paul would happen to him. Although Jesus didn't say it would happen while he was a prisoner. But back in chapter 9, when Luke tells the story of Paul's conversion, Jesus said about Paul, "This man is my chosen servant to carry my name before Gentiles and governors and kings and to the people of Israel." And so even though there have been all kinds of twists and turns in unexpected ways, God's sovereign will is moving forward in order to bring all these promises to pass, and that's what's happening right here, right now. But what I want to know is, in view of everything that Paul has gone through, what keeps him from being overcome by discouragement and despair? What causes him to step out of the prison with the gospel being the first thing that comes out of his mouth? What keeps him focused? What keeps him going? And I want to know this because I can tell you, difficulties have a way of distracting me and discouraging me, right? I mean, don't you find it almost impossible sometimes to keep your faith focused on the things of God when you're treated unfairly, or when you're stuck in the same place for a long time, or you're constantly interrupted and you can't do what you think you should be doing? It's very easy to get derailed, isn't it? But I don't see that in Paul. Not that he's above fear and anxiety and despair. Paul definitely struggled with all those kinds of things. He's made out of flesh and blood, just like you and me. But I don't see Paul incapacitated by all the bad things that he goes through. I don't see Paul pulling the covers over his head and not wanting to get out of the bed in the morning. Now, I see the exact opposite. I see that in chapters 24, 25, and 26, I see Paul stepping up to the plate and hitting home runs when he's been sitting on the bench for the entire season. He comes out of prison, and when the opportunity presents itself, he is focused, confident, and clear-headed. Now, let me show you what I mean in chapter 25. As I said, we're going to cover chapter 25 and 26 because they're all one story, and they ought to be kept together. In chapters 25 and 26, Paul appears before another Roman governor, Festus, not to be confused with Festus on Gunsmoke, but Festus, who replaced Felix. Just had to get you back with me here. But chapter 25 is really an introduction to Paul standing before King Agrippa in chapter 26, where then that's where Luke really shines the brightest spotlight. And so the problem is, in chapter 25, Festus doesn't know what to do with Paul because the Jews want him dead. They're so angry with him, but he can't figure out what's going on. So listen to how Festus relates the problem to King Agrippa, because he's wanting King Agrippa, the puppet king who rules over a small portion of northern Israel, he wants Agrippa to help him figure out the charges against Paul. So in chapter 25, verse 14, Festus says, "There's a man left in prison by Felix, and when I was in Jerusalem, the chief priests and elders of the Jews laid out a case against him, asking for a sentence of death against him. I told him that it wasn't the custom of the Romans to give up anyone before the accused met the accusers face to face and had the opportunity to make his defense concerning the charges against him. So when they came together here in Caesarea, I made no delay, but on the next day took my seat on the tribunal and ordered a man to be brought. And when the accusers stood up, they brought no charge in his case of such evils as I supposed. Rather, they had certain points of dispute with them about their own religion and about a guy named Jesus who was dead, but whom Paul asserts to be alive. Now, being at a loss how to investigate these questions, I asked whether he wanted to go to Jerusalem and be tried there, but Paul appealed to Caesar. And since he appealed to be kept in custody for the decision of the emperor, I ordered him to be held until I can send him to Caesar." Verse 25. "But I found that he had done nothing deserving of death, and as he himself had appeared to the emperor, I decided to go ahead and send him. But here's the problem. I have nothing definite to write about, to say about him to Caesar. Therefore, I brought him to you, especially to you, King Agrippa, so that after we have examined him, maybe you can help me write something. For it seems to me unreasonable in sending a prisoner to Caesar not to indicate the charges against him." So the point is, Festus didn't want to send Paul to stand before Caesar without a legitimate charge. And since the council meeting with the Jews didn't surface a charge that would stick, Festus was stuck. and he didn't know what to do. So he couldn't let Paul go without upsetting the Jews. He couldn't turn Paul over to the Jews because he knew they would kill him, and that would violate Paul's rights as a Roman citizen. He couldn't send him to Caesar without a formal charge. He would be viewed as inept and weak, so he was stuck. So Festus asked King Agrippa if he would listen to him. Now, King Agrippa, this is King Herod Agrippa II from a long line of King Herods. His family line traced back to Herod the Great, who was the Herod who had all the boy babies killed when Jesus was born. His son, Herod Antipas, beheaded John the Baptist. His grandson, Agrippa I, put the apostle James to death and tried to kill Peter. So Paul is before Agrippa II, the last of the Herods, and the great-grandson of King Herod. Now, here's the deal. Paul is going to stand trial before a man who comes from a long line of kings who have opposed the truth of the gospel from the beginning. Now, Bernice, my mother had a friend, Bernice, when I was growing up, and that's the only Bernice I've ever known, and Jim was here. He would say, don't name your child Bernice, but if you're, anyway. But Bernice, her story is complicated because it sounds like a soap opera. She was the sister of Felix's third wife, Drusilla, and the blood sister of Agrippa. Like they were from the hills of West Virginia, because Agrippa and Bernice were brother and sister practicing incest, which was a capital offense in Israel, and these are the people that Festus asked to help him come up with a charge against Paul. But really, this isn't a trial. It's more like entertainment. Luke says in verse 23 of chapter 25, the scene was one of great pomp. In other words, the king and the queen and all the royal officials and governing leaders, city leaders, everybody who was anybody was there, all decked out, banners waving, armor shining, all in their best robes. They're all there. It was like the opening ceremony of the Olympics. It was a visual spectacle, and it took place right here. And if you go to Israel with us, you'll be able to go to the amphitheater in Caesarea. They actually have concerts there. That's the Mediterranean Sea in the background. So imagine Paul standing down there, like at that little dark spot right in the middle in front of the stage, King Agrippa, Bernice, and Festus on the stage, and 5,000 people up. That's what this situation is like. All right, so Festus motions, Paul comes out. They take the chains off of him. He's chained to a Roman soldier. He's draped in a threadbare, dirty tunic that he's been wearing for 2 years, hair disheveled, matted, greasy, oily, his eyes probably red and swollen, still squinting as he tries to adjust to the light. And what Luke wants us to see is this contrast in this scene. You've got the royal best of the best looking down on this weak, unimportant troublemaker that nobody can make any sense of. Got the scene in your mind, chapter 26. As I read, listen to the confidence and the courage and the focus in Paul's voice. Does this man sound like a guy who's been wasting away in jail for 2 years? Does he sound like someone on the defensive or the offensive? Long chapter. We're going to read it all. Verse 1, so Agrippa said to Paul, Paul, you have permission to speak for yourself. And then Paul stretched out his hand and made this defense. King Agrippa, I consider myself blessed, that's what he says, blessed to be able to stand before you today, especially because I know that you are familiar with all the customs and controversies of the Jews. Therefore, I beg you to listen to me patiently. Now, my manner of life from my youth spent from the beginning among my own nation and in Jerusalem, it's known by all the Jews. They've known for a long time, if they're willing to admit it, that according to the strictest party of our religion, I've lived as a Pharisee. And now I stand here on trial because of my hope in the promise made to God our fathers, to which our 12 tribes hope to attain as they earnestly worship night and day. And for this hope, I'm accused by the Jews. Now, the hope is not the hope of a Messiah. The hope is the hope that God will raise the righteous dead, resurrection. Verse 8, why is it thought incredible by any of you that God raises the dead? All Pharisees believed in resurrection. Now, I believe in the resurrection, but I was convinced that I ought to do many things in the name of Jesus to oppose the way. I did so in Jerusalem. I not only locked up many saints in prison after receiving authority from the chief priests, but when they were put to death, I cast my vote against them, like with Stephen. And I punished them often in synagogues and tried to make them blaspheme. And in raging fury against them, I persecuted them even to foreign cities. And in this connection, I journeyed to Damascus with the authority of and commission of the chief priest to hunt Christians down and kill them. 13, at midday, O king, I saw on the way a light from heaven, brighter than the sun that shined around me, and those who journeyed with me saw it as well. And when we had fallen to the ground, I heard a voice saying to me in the Hebrew language, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? It's hard for you to kick against the goads. Meaning, a goad is a cattle prod. It was a long stick with a barb that would keep an ox moving forward. So Jesus is moving his mission forward, and he's saying, why are you opposing what I'm doing in the world? I said, who are you, Lord? And the Lord said, I'm Jesus, whom you're persecuting. But rise and stand on your feet, for I have appeared to you for this purpose, to appoint you as a servant and witness to the things that you have seen me, and to those things that I will appear to you and show you later, delivering you from your people and from the Gentiles to whom I'm sending you, to open their eyes so that they may turn from darkness to light and from the power of Satan to God, that they may receive the forgiveness of sins and a place among those who are sanctified by faith in me. He said, that's what I heard Jesus say, and O king, I was not disobedient to the heavenly vision, but I declared first to those in Damascus and then in Jerusalem and throughout all the region of Judea and also to the Gentiles that they should repent and turn to God, performing deeds in keeping with their repentance. Verse 21, for this reason the Jews seized me in the temple and tried to kill me. To this day I have had the help that comes from God, and so I stand here testifying to both small and great, saying nothing. Everything I'm saying is what the prophets and Moses said would come to pass. Now, here's the gospel. That the Christ must suffer and die, and that by being the first to rise from the dead, he would proclaim light both to our people and to the Gentiles. And as he was saying these things in his defense, Festus cried out in a loud voice, Paul, you are out of your mind. Your great learning is driving you mad. But Paul said, I'm not out of my mind, most excellent Festus. I'm speaking true and rational words, and the king knows about these things. And to him, I'm speaking to King Agrippa, I'm talking to him. For I'm persuaded that none of these things have escaped his notice. They haven't been done in a corner. King Agrippa, do you believe the prophets? I know you do. And Agrippa said, do you think, Paul, in such a short time you can convince me to become a Christian? And Paul said, whether short or long, I would to God that not only you, but all who hear me this day might become such as I am, except for these chains. Then the king rose, and the governor, and Bernice, and those who were sitting with him, and they, when they had withdrawn, they said to one another, this man has done nothing to deserve death or imprisonment. And Agrippa said to Festus, had he not appealed to Caesar, he could have been set free. Now I tell you, this blows my mind, because just like with Felix, Paul here is on the offensive. He's going for the jugular. He is going straight for Agrippa. Why? How so? Why? He's on purpose. He knows his God-given why, and that causes him to focus on Agrippa's need for Jesus rather than his own desire to be set free. So back to our question. In view of everything that Paul has been through, what keeps him from being overcome with discouragement and despair? What causes him to step out of prison, focused, confident, clear-headed, ready to share the gospel? And what I'm saying is, it is his why. It's his why. He's living from the inside out. What was Paul's why? What do you think? What did he say? He tells us, look at it once more. Paul's why was given to him, just like our why has been given to us. Verse 16, Jesus says to Paul, rise and stand on your feet, for I have appeared to you for this purpose, to give you this purpose, to give you your why, if I could say it that way. You are my chosen servant and witness to the things you will experience in me. My paraphrase. I'm sending you to everyone everywhere so you can do for them what I've done for you. To open blind eyes. And Paul doesn't talk about that part of his story, but Paul was made blind by the vision, and then his eyes were opened. to open blind eyes so they can turn from darkness to light and from the power of Satan to God, so they can receive the forgiveness of sins and a share among those who are sanctified, set apart by their faith in me. That's Paul's why, to be a life changer, a game changer, a world changer. He lived inside out. Now, I want you to think about this, because if we were interviewing Paul and we said, Paul, tell us what your golden circle looks like. What's your why? Paul would say, well, I never really thought about it in terms like that. But you could say my why is Jesus chose me to give to others what he's given to me, to give them the gospel so that through faith in Jesus they could be forgiven of their sins and become a part of the family of God. Well, Paul, how are you doing that? Well, I was a traveling preacher and a church planter, but now I'm the Lord's prisoner, called to tell governors and kings and even Caesar who Jesus is, who the real king is. You ask, what am I? I'm Paul the prisoner. And I'm good with that, kind of. Paul lived inside out. His why shaped his what and how. When his what and how changed from being a traveling preacher and church planter to being a prisoner, it did not permanently throw him off course. He just changed course, but he still lived out of his why. Now, think about how different his life would be if he lived outside in, like from what to why. If Paul focused first on what he was, Paul the prisoner, like I'm a prisoner, if he focused on his what, I guarantee you his mind would naturally gravitate, naturally end up being focused on himself. I'm falsely accused. This is unfair. I'm unfairly treated. He would be in utter despair sitting in prison for 2 stinking years. I mean, think about it. How focused, how confident would he be if what happened to him replaced his why for living? And if Paul focused on his what, I'm a prisoner, then his how gets confusing. I don't get it, God. I'm supposed to be out there traveling and preaching the gospel and planting churches. I don't remember prison ever being a part of this deal. And if his how gets confusing, then his why gets fuzzy. Like, God, why have you let all these bad things happen to me? This can't be the way that you've called me to serve you. And the result is discouragement and despair, right? But see, if Paul starts with his God-given why, I live for Christ, why? To give to others what he's given to me, then his how can be out there preaching the gospel and planting churches, or it can be in prison preaching the gospel and planting the seeds of the gospel into anybody who will listen to him. And his what, I'm a prisoner of the Lord, he learned to be content with what God chose for him, because Paul would say, I can still give others what God has given to me. I can still preach the gospel, whether it's to the soldier I'm chained to, or the people who come to visit me, or the governors or the kings I stand before to make my defense. You say, here's the deal. Here's why Luke tells Paul's conversion story 3 times. Here's why you and I are sitting here today, why Christianity exists today. Because people who believe the gospel, Paul believed, took up his cause. They made his why their why, and they told other people about it, and many of them gave their lives for it, and it's come down to us to do the same today. So let's bring this down to where we live. I'm saying, as a follower of Jesus, learning to live out of your why rather than your what can sustain you through your most difficult days. Learning to live out of your why rather than your what can sustain you during your most difficult days. Your what, why is that? Because your what can change. Your what is fragile, it's flimsy, it's too easily impacted by the changing circumstances of your life. Now, I'm not saying your what and how are unimportant. Of course it's important. I'm just saying your what is not foundational to who you are, because it can change so easily. You can lose your job. You might come up short as an athlete and not get that scholarship. The relationship you hoped would work out may not work out. Your kids grow up and they leave home. Then who are you when you're an empty nester? Your company may not thrive. You might enter a season of life where you encounter one conflict after another. Those kinds of things can take a toll on our what and our how. Again, Paul's what, I'm a traveling preacher and church planter, That changed, but it didn't change why he got out of the bed in the morning in that dark prison cell, because his why motivated him to look for any opportunity to give to others what Jesus had given to him. How did he put it in verse 29? Look at this. This is the whole thing. He said, he's talking to King Agrippa. He says, King Agrippa says, you think you're going to make me a Christian in such a short time, like after one speech? And Paul says, I would to God that you and every single person in here would be like me. That's his why. I want to give you what Jesus has given to me. I wish you all were like me except for these chains. His why empowered him to put Jesus on display in the worst circumstances. And what I'm saying is, well, let's play the toddler game with your life. Let's just peel away some whys. Why do you get up in the morning? Well, you say, well, I got to get up in the morning to go to work. Why do you go to work? To put food on the table. Why do you need to put food on the table? To feed my family. Okay, why do you need to feed your family? Oh, this is crazy. I mean, if you don't eat, you die. Why do you need to stay alive? To put food on the table? No. Yeah. See, for a follower of Jesus, there's a why deeper than to feed my family or stay alive or to get as much out of life as I can. Your why is your purpose. The Bible tells us your why and my why are the same as Paul's why. Jesus has given us our why. And going way up the ladder of abstraction, I could say it like this. As a follower of Jesus, you're alive to give others what Jesus has given to you. You're alive to give others what Jesus has given to you. Now, to be sure, your what and how are different from Paul's. God probably hasn't called you to be a traveling preacher or a traveling church planter or a prisoner. Your what may be school teacher, bank teller, doctor, stay-at-home mom, stay-at-home dad, exec, corporate exec, nurse, construction worker, entrepreneur, maid, engineer, pastor, administrative assistant, minister, whatever. Your what and the particular how you go about doing your what are meant to flow out of your core why, your core belief that Jesus has a purpose for your life, a what and a how that flow out of a God-given, gospel-driven why. And that why is, at least in my thinking, to give to others what Jesus has given to you. Now think about it. In everyday life, no matter what you do or how you do it, if your why is something like, I'm here to give to others what Jesus has given to me, then you will want to tell other people about Jesus, about how they can find forgiveness and life and hope by faith in Jesus, because you found forgiveness and hope and life by faith in Jesus. You want to take seriously opportunities where you can share Jesus and how Jesus can change people's lives because he's changed your life. But it goes beyond that. Your God-given, gospel-driven why also means you forgive because you have been forgiven. It means you don't condemn other people because Christ does not condemn you. It means you love people who hate you or people who don't care for you or people who are unlovable or hard to love because Jesus has poured out his love on you. You serve others because Jesus serves you. You give your life away for others with no expectation of return because Jesus has given his life away for you. You give generously to further God's work in the world because God is generous to you. You give to others forgiveness, grace, love, care, service, kindness, patience, peace, and faithfulness because all those things are what Jesus has given to you. Your God-given, gospel-driven why defines your life no matter what your what is or how your how is. And it also means that we put the gospel on display in the most difficult circumstances because Jesus went through the most difficult circumstances imaginable when he died to save us. You know Jesus, why? You know what was Jesus, why? Well, I'm sure you could say it in all kinds of different ways, but the writer of Hebrews put it this way in chapter 12, verses 1 through 3, when he tells us to keep our eyes fixed on Jesus when we're going through rough times. He says, lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and perfecter of our faith. Now here's his why. Who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despised the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. You see, Jesus' why was the joy that would be his in giving his life to save us. The joy of knowing that one day all who put their faith and trust in him would stand before him in heaven with him as he's seated at the right hand of the throne of God. His why, giving his life for us, was his source of joy. And if your why and my why is gospel-driven, to give to others what Jesus has given to us, then we will experience his joy as well, no matter if life circumstances change your what and your how. So the question is, what is your why? Would you pray with me? Father God, thank you for what we read in your word and what a challenge it is to be invited into a radically different kind of life, the life that you've really designed for us to live. We come into a place like this and we hear a message like this and we want to take it in. We want to change. We want to absorb it. We want to live out of our why, but we live in such a complex, distracting world where our minds are always just constantly being pulled off course. But God, I pray that no matter what we do when we go out of here, no matter how we do what we do when we go out of here, that each of us would begin living from this why of giving to other people what Jesus has given to us in all of the variegated forms of what that means. Holy Spirit, empower us to do that for the sake of Jesus' greater fame. Amen.